Believe in yourself, cause it starts with you, and then everyone else will believe you too. And if it looks like you're the only believer around, just keep on believing, don't put yourself down, just believe.
Our guest this week grew up in Montgomery, Alabama, and earned a doctorate of philosophy in physics from the University of Virginia. NASA selected her to be an astronaut in 1985. A veteran of four space flights, she spent 975 hours in space, including 21 hours of extravehicular activity, as the second woman to ever walk in space, dangling by a tether while going 18,000 miles per hour. A modern-day hero, her name, Dr. Katherine Thornton. And I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. I'm Jack Krasula. This is Anything Is Possible, and we're talking to a most unbelievable, amazing lady, Dr. Katherine Thornton. Doctor, welcome. What an honor to have you.
Thank you so much.
Can we start by talking about your childhood and your mom and your dad?
Well, I just sort of had an ordinary childhood growing up in Alabama. I had three brothers and two sisters. Just a regular kid. Went to school, wasn't particularly outstanding in school until I guess high school. Maybe I blossomed a little bit more, but just a regular kid, liked to play outside and take things apart and just explore.
What's the biggest thing, Katherine, you learned from mom, and what's the biggest thing you learned from dad?
Wow, those are tough questions. My mother didn't have nearly the opportunities that I did. I think that maybe she was a generation too soon. She would try things that people told her were impossible. Like I can remember wanting to hang wallpaper on our sand finished plaster walls, and everyone at the hardware store told her it can't be done, and so she did it. She did that sort of thing, but it was a different time back then. In the 50s when I was growing up, or in the 60s when I was growing up, different time for women. And I think she could have done a lot of amazing things had she been born a generation later.
Well, she raised you. That was the most amazing thing. When you were young, what were your passions and what were your dreams?
It's so hard to remember that stuff. I was just sort of a regular kid. Never really had a life's plan. I still don't. I'm still looking for what comes next. I didn't have any idea what I wanted to do when I grow up, and I'm still working on that as well. I did reasonably well in school and in the early days. You just do what you're supposed to do. But then in high school, I sort of discovered that I like science and math, and that sort of carried me on into college days and graduate days, where I found out something that I did well. I was a good student, and I like being a student, so I stayed in it through a PhD when eventually they tell you you have to go out in the world and get a real job.
Did you ever dream about being an astronaut?
When I was growing up, it wasn't an option. There weren't many astronauts, and they were all men, and they were all test pilots, and it was pretty clear I didn't fit that mold. And so that was never really one of my ambitions back in those days. It just came up as sort of an opportunity that appeared, and I jumped on it.
We're talking to Dr. Katherine Thornton, who earned a B.S. degree and an M.S. degree in physics from Auburn University, and then a doctorate of philosophy in physics from the University of Virginia. Doctor, to the common person, what is physics?
Physics is just how the world works. It's how things move, why they move. It's a puzzle. It's always a puzzle to try to figure things out, and that's what I always enjoyed about it. When I was studying physics as an undergraduate, I'm taking other classes as well. I knew if I was studying German and had to do a translation, I knew about how long it would take to do that because it's pretty straightforward. You just do it. But looking at a physics problem, you never really knew. You could see it in 10 seconds or you could spend 5 hours on the same problem. So it was very much a puzzle and still is.
From 1980 to 1984, you were a physicist at the United States Army Foreign Science and Technology Center. What did you do in those years?
We were looking through open source materials mostly at what other countries were doing in areas of science and technology and how that might have potential implications in weapons programs they might be developing. So it's pretty much read reports, write reports.
A day that changed your life forever, May 23rd, 1984. Tell us what happened.
Well, I had earlier seen an announcement that NASA was selecting their next group of astronauts, and that would have been the third group to include women. And it had the procedure for how to apply, and so I just found the application and went online, and or it wasn't even online, I guess it was on paper, and sent it in and just sort of forgot about it. It was sort of a, you know, like buying a lottery ticket. You don't really expect to win it. So I just went about my business, and several months later, I got a call from NASA saying, would you like to come here to Houston to interview for this astronaut job? And I thought, wow, yeah, sure, I'd love to do that. So I went to Houston for a week's worth of interview and medical tests and that sort of thing with probably 20 other people. That year, NASA interviewed, I think, 120 in groups of 20 at a time. And so I met some very interesting people, had a great time, thought I'd never see Houston again in my life, and went on home and went about my business. And then on May 23rd, I got a call saying, hey, would you like to come down and do this?
There were 5,000 applicants. They selected only 17. What did you do that night when they told you?
Well, that's sort of a hard story. My husband was a professor here at the University of Virginia, and he wasn't interested in moving to Houston. So we had some pretty serious discussions about, you know, our life and our life together and how we were going to pull this off. And we came to an understanding and agreement, and I went to Houston, took our two-year-old daughter. He stayed in Virginia, and we commuted for 12 years. But so the first few days of that were not as much fun as you might have imagined. It was really, really tough time.
The first astronauts were selected in 1958. The first female astronaut was selected in 1978. There's only been 43 women to be in space. And our guest today has been up 4 trips. When we come back, we'll talk about some of those other 10 women. And I'm Jack Crisula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. Welcome back to Anything Is Possible. I'm Jack Crisula, and we're with Dr. Katherine Thornton. NASA selected her to be an astronaut in 1985. Doctor, the first woman in space, a Russian, Valentina Tereshkova, and our first American in space, Sally Ride. Tell us about the first few women from America in space.
The first astronaut group that included women was the first group for the shuttle program, and they were selected in 1978. There were 6 women that were part of that. And they were really the trailblazers, I think, for the rest of us. They were, you know, at the time that NASA wasn't used to dealing with women and how to provision them for space and that sort of thing. The clothes were different, obviously, and so it was, you know, they had to work through a lot of stuff and earn the respect of all the guys that they worked with and all the other people that are part of NASA, and they did a great job of that. One thing that I really, really appreciated about being part of the space program was that they have to value people for what they bring to the table and not for how they look or gender or anything like that. You're part of a team, and the team has a common goal, and what you can bring to the table is your value to the team. And so it didn't matter so much whether you were a man or a woman. Sort of the divisions, if you can imagine, the pecking order in the astronaut office was, you know, the pilots were sort of at the top, and then there were sort of the military, other military people who were flight test engineers, and then the sort of the civilians always seemed to be, at least in my view, sort of at the bottom of that. So it wasn't broken on gender. It was broken on other things. But it was still a wonderful experience with lots of great people who were a team and wanted to accomplish a goal.
4 years after you were selected, November 22nd, 1989, your first flight, STS-33, 79 orbits, 5 days. Tell us about that flight, please.
That flight was, it was kind of interesting because it was one of the classified missions where everything that we would say air to ground didn't go to the entire world. It was all very closed off. Our launch time was not announced. Very, very closed. Whereas, you know, a lot of people, their first flight in space, they get to be on television, their families get to see them in space, all this cool stuff. And we had none of that because we were classified. So I think it was probably harder for our families because they couldn't see what was going on. But as far as I was concerned, I loved it because we were could be more relaxed in our conversation with the ground. We had a great time. We did some good work. I can't tell you what it is, but if I could, you would thank us. But we laughed every day of training. We laughed all through the mission. We just had an incredible time together, even though we weren't not taking the job seriously. The job was very, very serious, and the mission was very, very serious. But we didn't take ourselves very seriously. We just had so much fun on that mission. But I can't tell you about it.
Many people told you what it was going to be like, the takeoff, et cetera. What was it like when it actually happened?
For me, it's sort of like watching myself do it. You know, I don't remember any fear when I went out to the launch pad and climbed in and strapped in the seat. It was more kind of, you know, you made the decision to do this. You're not going to turn around and back out. You're not rethinking that decision. And you trust that everybody who had anything to do with it has done the best they could to make it safe. You trust that your training is good and any problems that can be handled, you can handle and the rest of your team can handle. And you don't worry about the stuff you can't do anything about. And so I don't remember fear. I remember just, you know, matter-of-factly going through the process of everything in that day, strapping in and getting ready to go. Probably more than the fear of getting hurt is the fear that they're going to scrub the mission and you're going to have to come back and do it again tomorrow rather than getting launched. And so that was kind of my overwhelming thought going into it, is listening to the communications back and forth between the shuttle and the launch control center and hoping not to hear something like launch commit criteria violation or weather problems or anything that would make us not launch that day. It was pretty amazing, though, when the solid rocket booster's lit, you know you're going. You can't turn it around at that point, so you are launching. And then it was a matter of just watching the time from launch, because after a couple minutes you can't turn around and go back to Florida, and after so many minutes you know you're not going to do an abort to Africa, and after so many minutes you know you're getting to orbit. So just watching the clock and getting through those gates and trying to just remember the physical sensations, the vibrations in the first stage and the acceleration being pushed back in the seat and that sort of thing. I was trying to absorb all that because you never know if you get a chance to do it again, and I wanted to try to remember all that.
We're talking to Dr. Catherine Thornton. Speaking of doing it again, a veteran of 4 space flights, Catherine spent 975 hours in space, and you did it again, second time, STS-49, May 7th, 1992, 141 orbits, 9 days. Tell us about that trip.
That was the first flight of the Space Shuttle Endeavor. And our job was to go, was to launch and capture a communication satellite that was stuck in an unusable low Earth orbit, strap a new booster motor on it, and send it up to geosynchronous orbit where it could actually work. That one was kind of interesting in that so many things went wrong. That we wouldn't have anticipated. We had trouble catching the satellite. We had one of the astronauts on the end of the mechanical arm with a capture bar that he was supposed to attach to the satellite and grab it. The satellite weighed about 9,000 pounds on Earth. It was a pretty massive thing. And the capture bar didn't work. He ended up pushing it away from us, putting it in kind of a flat spin. We separated from it, and ground controllers stabilized it. The next day we went back and tried it again. Still couldn't capture it with a capture bar. Separated, ground controllers got control of it. We spent a day in orbit, and folks on the ground spent a day trying to figure out how we're going to do this. We had one more chance. We had enough fuel to do it one more time, but we had to be sure that that was successful. So together, we came up with a plan of sending 3 people out, 3 spacewalkers out, to grab it basically with their hands. We'd never sent 3 people out and do a spacewalk before, and it happened since, as a matter of fact. It's the only time. And that's because the airlock is sized to handle 2 people. The communication radios are set up for 2 people. There are umbilicals in the airlock to give oxygen and cooling and electricity to 2 people. So there was a real process to figure out, you know, whether it was a safe thing to do to try to send three folks out. And we collectively decided it was. And the philosophy kind of changed before the flight. If you had suggested that three people go out, it would have been, okay, prove to us that this is safe. In orbit, it got to be, prove to us that this isn't safe before we sent these guys out. And it turns out we worked. We sent them out. They caught it with their hands, strapped the new booster motor on, and the next day we deployed it, sent it out. And this particular satellite, this is in 1992 in May, and it carried the Summer Olympics from Barcelona to the United States. That satellite did 3 months later.
Third flight, STS-61, December 2nd, 1993, 163 orbits, 11 days. Very famous flight. You and your team fixed the Hubble telescope. Please.
That one was unique in that everything went right. It was a very, very complex mission, not difficult in the sense of very, very hard things to do, but critical that each thing be done correctly so that the satellite would survive our visit and be better than it was before. That one was interesting because we had a lot of independent teams and panels and committees looking over everything before the flight. And so a lot of folks involved in making sure that it was a good plan before we launched. And then once we got into orbit, everything, we had very few problems. Everything went pretty much as we had planned it. We put in a new wide-field and planetary camera, and that's the device that sends back the incredibly gorgeous pictures that Hubble sends back. That had optics inside of it, had mirrors inside of it that corrected the problem that Hubble had with the primary mirror that's not exactly the way it should be. It distorts the light, and so this camera would pick up that light and correct it before it went into the instrument. So that's what has made it able to send these amazing pictures to us. We had another device that we stuck in. We had to remove one of the instruments to put this in, and this was a box about the size of a telephone booth, if you can remember what those used to be back in the old days, that we put inside the telescope that had other corrections for the other instruments on board. We changed out the solar arrays because they were giving some vibration problems. One of them didn't roll up like it was supposed to, so we could bring it home, and so we ended up jettisoning that one into space. And we had some computer memory and with other fixes to the telescope. When we landed, which was mid-December of 1993, we didn't know whether what we had done had made the telescope better or not. We knew that the instruments we'd put in were communicating with the ground. They powered up. But the controllers couldn't really turn on the telescope until after we were a long way away from it. And so when we landed, we really didn't let our hair down and have a big celebration, yay, Hubble's fixed, because nobody knew if it was. So when the pictures first started coming out in January, they were announced in Washington, and that was the first we heard. We didn't get any advanced information, but that's the first we heard that the fixes were right on and that Hubble was better than it had originally planned to be. So that was when the big celebration happened, after we all knew that the whole mission was a success.
We're talking to Dr. Catherine Thornton, who spent 21 hours walking in space. When we come back, we'll talk to her about that. And I'm Jack Rasool, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. This is Anything Is Possible. I'm your host, Jack Krasula, and we're with Dr. Catherine Thornton, who spent 21 hours walking in space. She walked twice in the Hubble telescope mission. Hanging from a tether, doctor, going 18,000 miles an hour. Tell us what that's like.
You know, when you're outside doing a spacewalk, you really have no sensation of motion because you're traveling at the same speed as the space shuttle. You're tied on with a little quarter-inch steel tether. But there's no sensation of motion. There's really no sensation of height, except occasionally if you're on the mechanical arm and you get way above the cargo bay, you can get a sensation of height above the cargo bay, but not height several hundred miles above the Earth. You just don't feel that. When astronauts get ready to go outside, the doctors see the highest heart rate because we are instrumented. And that's not, in my opinion, that's not because we're afraid of getting hurt out there. We're afraid we're going to mess up. And spacewalking time is so precious, and the jobs we have to do are so critical that you're really more concerned that, oh, can I do this? You're in a suit that is pressurized, generally higher than it was when you trained, and so it's stiffer, it's harder to bend, it's harder to make, to let you do what you want to do. Switches that you could reach before become exceedingly hard, at least for me, to get to, and that's your first indication that this is the real deal. This is not training anymore. And so you start thinking, oh my gosh, I've signed up to do all these things. I hope I can really do it. There's occasionally some sensation of being lost because there's no up or down, and you can get to a place looking maybe over the top of the crew module, and all of a sudden you sort of lose your references and you don't know which way is fore or aft, you don't know which way is up or down until you look around and finally find a reference that your eyes recognize, and then instantly you sort of know where you are. So occasionally that would happen when I was on the end of the mechanical arm and I was being moved around in the cargo bay, and I was focused mostly on working with the tools in my hand, so I wasn't looking at what was going on around me. And next time I looked up, I was in an entirely different orientation and place than I was the last time I looked. And I would be very, you know, momentarily sort of disoriented as to where am I? And then your mind finds something, and then you sort of latch onto it, and you know where you are. But it's really kind of fun.
Doctor, what does Earth look like from 250 to 300 miles up in space?
You know, what we do in the shuttle program is really a high-altitude flight. It's not like being separated from the Earth. If you could shrink the Earth to the size of a basketball, a typical shuttle orbit is about a quarter inch above that surface. So we're really very close to the Earth in that sense. So it's more like it looks like when you look out the window of an airplane, except we have a much wider view because we are much higher than that, but not significantly different than that.
Your fourth flight, STS-73, October 20th, 1995, 256 orbits, 16 days. Tell us about the fourth and final trip up.
My fourth flight was a space lab flight, which meant that in the cargo bay, instead of having satellites, we had a space lab module, which is like a big pressurized volume. And we would get to it by just floating through the airlock, so it had atmospheric pressure, it was temperature controlled, it was just like being at home, sort of, if you could float in your house. And that gave us the opportunity to have a lot of experiments that benefited from having no apparent gravity. And by that I mean that we are falling. The space shuttle is free-falling around the Earth, we're free-falling in it, so we're floating and don't feel like we have gravity. Obviously we do, or we would continue in a straight line forever. We couldn't orbit the Earth without gravity. But when you kind of you take that out of the equations by floating, you can learn things, scientific phenomena, for instance, or physical phenomena, remove that complication of gravity from the equations. You get a more simplified view of how things work that maybe then we can bring back here to Earth. So we had about 35 different experiments. Some of them dealt with the physics of fluids in a zero-gravity environment. Some of them had to do with growing crystals from either a melt or from solutions. And those crystals could form in the liquid without being pulled to the bottom of the test tube like you would down here. And so we could learn different things about that. So it was a very interesting flight. We had two-shift operation, which meant that half the crew slept while the other half was awake and working. So we kept the lab in operation 24 hours a day for almost 2 weeks. A lot more space to move around in and live in than we normally had without the space lab module. Half the people to deal with in that space, so it was amazing. It was to have this huge environment just to live in and to move around in, as opposed to being crammed in something the size of a minivan for a couple weeks.
Doctor, four space flights, 41 days total. What surprised you the most in those four trips?
Wow, that's a good question. I think the first time, what is most surprising is you plan for all the major events you have to do. So when you're spacewalking, you plan down to the level of this hand goes here and next this hand goes here and all that. But the things that you don't plan for, you just sort of take for granted are the everyday living things, like At one point on the first flight, I had to throw a switch and put my hand and key the mic with my other hand. So standing in the trainer, that was easy. You pulled the switch up and then moved it to the right position while I was keying the mic with my other hand. And I should have known this, but in orbit, I was about 3 seconds from having to do that when I realized I can't pull this switch unless I also push with my hand because I'm floating. I have to be able to react that force, which meant I had to let go of the microphone. I managed to do that, but those are the things. It's the everyday things. You know, you put your toothpaste on your toothbrush and you start brushing your teeth, and then you start thinking, okay, now where am I going to spit this? You know, I have no sink here. I didn't think about that beforehand. So it's kind of those everyday things. You just part of your life that I didn't think through in that environment. So it were always kind of funny things that were surprising to me. It was great to be able to do flips like we were gymnasts at the Olympics, except you can flip and go up, but you can't flip and come back down unless you bounce off the ceiling. So we had a few other maneuvers they couldn't do.
You've had a lot of glorious days in your life. Another one was June 5th, 2010. You're inducted into the Astronaut Hall of Fame, and at the time you were only the third woman to hold this honor. Tell us about that day.
That was amazing. It's always nice to be recognized by your peers, people who really know what you do and what you did. And so that was probably the biggest honor I've ever had, is to be recognized by my peers as part of that group. It's been great working with the Astronaut Scholarship Foundation that does the Astronaut Hall of Fame. They raise money for college scholarships at 25 or 26 universities and make a difference in those students' lives and careers, and it's just fabulous working with that group.
When you were there and certain iconic astronauts, whether it was Neil Armstrong, Buzz Aldrin, Jack Lausma, on and on and on, came up to you and congratulated you one after another, what was that like?
That was truly amazing. Those guys, you know, were my heroes back from a long time ago. They did amazing things in leaving the Earth, much more so than we do. And so I could just listen to their stories all day long. And that's a great part of going down for that event is getting to hang out with those guys that I didn't really know that well because they were long gone before I went to Houston. They'd moved on to other things for the most part. And just to sit there and listen to their stories, I get goosebumps. I'm a groupie hanging around those guys.
Was there one that was bigger than life?
A lot of them are. A lot of them are. You look back at what they did, and they don't... they talk about them just like you would talk about your summer vacation or what you did last week. They're not bragging. They're just, telling it like it was. And they're just amazing guys to listen to.
I had Gene Cernan on years ago, and he talked about that the technology that they went to the moon with was less than we have in our GPS tracker or our cell phone. Talk about the technology they used or lack thereof.
Wow, I can't even think back to that time because, technology they had is less than what you have in your wristwatch, probably. When I started flying the shuttle, our computers had 256K memory on them. And we had software stored on magnetic tape on board that we would have to transfer into the computers. And they were, 20 years before that. They were way, way beyond that before that. So I can't even imagine. I think most everything was done with slide rules.
We're talking to Dr. Catherine Thornton. When we come back, we'll ask her about her life today at the University of Virginia. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. Welcome back to Anything Is Possible. I'm Jack Rasula, and we're with Dr. Catherine Thornton, veteran of 4 space flights. She spent 975 hours in space. Last fall, you and a few other people from University of Virginia took 575 college students on a 3-month trip on a ship. Tell us about that experience.
I was on the Fall 13 Voyage of Semester at Sea, which is a program that's run by the Institute for Shipboard Education and the University of Virginia as the academic partner that owns the ship. It's a former cruise ship that travels around the world with students. It becomes a floating university. So we had 80 classes. We had about 40 faculty. We had 575 students, and we started in the UK. We went to St. Petersburg in Russia. We went to Hamburg, Germany, and then Antwerp, Le Havre. We did a jog over to Dublin, and then we went down the coast of Lisbon and Spain and down the African coast, including Morocco, Ghana, and Cape Town, South Africa, across the Atlantic Ocean to South America and back up, and our last stop was Cuba. And it was an amazing experience for everybody involved. Every day at sea is a class day because we have to get a full semester's worth of classwork done. Every day in port is not, where students were allowed to travel on their own and explore on their own. Most of them had class assignments to observe something relevant to their class. If their class was about energy, they were supposed to observe the energy sources, water resources, art, music, sociology, all those things. They would have assignments pretty much to do dealing with in port, and then would come back to the ship for classes as we made the next journey to the next port. It was a fabulous experience, and most of us want to go back tomorrow.
Speaking of students, many grade school girls are very, very good at math. The ones I went to school with, all of them were better at math than me, yet so few of our women choose a career in math, engineering, and/or science. Why?
You know, that's a good question. I'm a slip-through, so I can't tell you why they don't, because I did. I think it's, you know, there's two ways we can get more women and more everybody into the STEM fields. One is to try to push them by emphasizing it in elementary and in high school. And the other is to pull them, is to have interesting careers that are pulling these students toward them. And I think we have to do both if we want to encourage that. I teach engineering students, and I think about close to a third of them are young women, and they are, you know, just as good as anybody else. They are just as willing to speak out. They're often the leaders in the class. I noticed that we have a board that lists the outstanding student of the year here in the engineering school at UVA. Half of those are women. So, you know, it's not that they can't excel. They know they can. They know they can, but they choose not to for various reasons, including, you know, perhaps that pull is not there that offers them the career and the life that they want.
On March 8th, 2012, you gave a speech, Space Flight, A Human Perspective, and I quote you, "In this space age, we are just beginning to explore the solar system and human space flights into Earth orbit are our first baby steps off our home planet." Dr. Thornton, what does the future hold for space flight?
We will send people to Mars. I don't know whether it will be in my lifetime, whether I'll ever see it, but there's no doubt in my mind that that is in the future, because that's what we do. We are biologically programmed to explore, and we're going to do that, whether we choose to do that in this country, whether we choose to do that as part of an international endeavor, remains to be seen, but there's absolutely no doubt in my mind that we are going to send people away from this planet once again. You know, when the guys went to the moon, that was a pretty big step compared to what we've done for the last 40 years, which is just go around the Earth over and over again. I think that we can do that. There's no doubt we can do that. It's just a matter of when and who's going to do it.
So many of us admire you, Dr. Catherine Thornton. Who do you most admire?
Wow, that's a good question. You know, I don't know that I can name anybody right off. I don't have any sort of hero that's been someone that I have followed in the footsteps. I admire people who have a vision. I admire people who go after that vision. I admire people who understand that any great endeavor involves a team of people, and that every single person on that team is as valuable as anybody else. Those are the kind of people that I look up to, and I see that in a lot of people, and try to mimic isn't right the right word, but sort of follow the example of people when I see that they're doing that.
People meet you and they see, wow, what a lady of courage. Dr. Robert Schuller, years ago, said this about courage. Courage is a decision. The truth is that courage isn't a gift, it's a decision. Courage is not the absence of fear, it's the presence of a calling, a dream that pulls you beyond yourself. Hence, it's something you can never lose. It's always something that you can choose. Talk to us about courage.
Well, I have to agree that courage isn't being able to it's facing your fear. It's not the absence of fear. It's certainly facing your fear. You know, I have no problem with heights. I don't mind climbing to the top of a ladder. But if someone does have a problem with heights, climbing to the top of that ladder does involve a lot of courage. It just doesn't for me. So I don't know that I've exhibited great courage. Maybe I exhibit not a lot of common sense when I strap myself on a rocket. But, you know, I don't know that there was a whole lot of fear involved in that. There's a lot of trust involved in that. There's a lot of trust that folks who put all that stuff together did the best they could to make it safe. So I think for me, the things that I've done are not so much facing down my fear, but putting my trust in teams of people that I think are doing the right thing.
Catherine Thornton, what dreams and goals do you still have?
Another good question. You know, I don't know. At my age, I'm looking for one more adventure, maybe two more adventures out there, and I'm not quite sure what those are. I would love to go back and do Semester at Sea again. I had a blast doing that. But I don't know what my next adventure is going to be. I'm still looking.
As our time winds down together, what advice would you give to our young listeners?
I talk to students here, and I advise undergraduate students here, and I always tell them that you have so many choices out there that it's tough to pick one, but you have to. You have to choose one. Don't look back. Head out that path. If that takes you somewhere you don't want to be, then change your path. But don't ever look back. You can't rewrite history. You can't redo things. You can only look forward from where you are at this point.
Dr. Catherine Thornton, you're a modern-day American hero. Thanks for all you've done. You got a great future. Please keep up the great work.
Thank you so much.
Please join us next Sunday. Until then, I'm Jack Rasula. Thanks for listening, and make it a great week, because with God, anything is possible. Spohn.